This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For Eagles fans, the first game of the season couldn't have gone any better. It was Eagles with a decisive win over the Browns, and if rookie quarterback Carson Wentz was nervous, he didn't show it. Completing 22 of his 37 attempts, there were no turnovers, there were two touchdowns, and at the end of the day, the score was 29-10, so a lot of people went home happy. However, Wentz took a lot of hits, so are there concerns about protection? And the Browns did not put up much of a fight. So realistically, what's next for the Birds? Lines are open. What do you think of the start to the 2016 season? Call us at 888-477-9499, or you can tweet us at Radio Times, WHYY Radio Times, that is. So in studio with us right now to help us pick this apart is Mike Sielski, sports columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Welcome back to Radio Times, Mike.
Thanks for having me, Mary.
And Ray Dinger is football analyst for Comcast Sports. And it's great to have you back as well, Ray.
Same here.
What'd you think, Ray? You first.
it was a very, very impressive first outing for the young quarterback and also for the rookie head coach. I thought they both acquitted themselves very well. A lot of questions going into this game, and a lot of people coming out of it are going to say, "Well, it was only the Cleveland Browns." And the Cleveland Browns, neither Mike nor I are going to sit here and try and make a case for the Cleveland Browns being a Super Bowl contender, but. Just to evaluate what it was, I thought the quarterback played very well. He absolutely didn't look like a rookie. He looked very composed. He looked very in control. Threw the ball extremely well, and the head coach gave him a lot of latitude in terms of running the game and doing the things. And they went out there, and I think the fans were excited, but there was a certain amount of reservation about just how is this going to go. And I think they walked out of there absolutely believing that they've got. The question a lot of people had is, you know, is this kid going to be a franchise quarterback? Do we finally have a quarterback? And I think everybody walked out of there feeling like, yeah, I think we do.
Mike Sielski, I was wondering, were the Eagles that good or the Browns that bad?
Well, it's a little bit of both. You know, Ray is right that I think Carson Wentz would have been impressive given some of the throws that he made and the decisions that he made during the game. He would have been impressive against just about any NFL team, but I don't think you can sell short the fact that the Cleveland Browns are kind of the 76ers of the NFL right now. They took a 3-13 team from last year and basically hollowed it out, you know, to try to be even worse in a way to accumulate draft picks and really try to rebuild from the ground up. So this has the potential to be a pretty bad team and really already is. So you do have to take that into some consideration. But as Ray said, in terms of just looking like a comfortable, seasoned NFL quarterback, Carson Wentz met every expectation in that regard yesterday.
I was surprised. He just looked so cool.
He did. And
composed.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, the Eagles had kind of, for lack of a better way of putting it, kind of put up this story or this front that throughout the offseason that Sam Bradford was going to be our starting quarterback, and Carson, because he played so little both at North Dakota State and during the preseason, would need time to learn. Well, then they traded Sam Bradford, and Carson becomes the starter, and apparently he didn't need all that much time to learn. So it makes you wonder what good would have been done by having him sit on the bench behind either Sam Bradford or Chase Daniel.
Yeah, and Ray, as you mentioned earlier, he started right off throwing the ball within, I think, 4 minutes. There was a touchdown pass.
Yeah, it was, and I give the coach credit for, I think, building a really smart game plan for him. I mean, they got the ball first drive, 9 plays, 75 yards. And it looked as if, in my view, that Peterson kind of built it almost step by step in that drive. Like the first three throws that Wentz had were all to the tight ends, and they were all really easy throws. They gave him a chance to get a little bit of confidence and a little bit of a rhythm going. And then as they moved further down the field, then he began to open it up a little bit and open it up a little bit. And then finally they got down to the 19-yard line. And then he asked him to make a really tough throw into the corner of the end zone to Jordan Matthews, and he made it. If you start with that play, maybe he doesn't make it. But I think by the time you get to the end of the drive, he's starting to feel into the flow of the game, and he threw that ball with real confidence and certainly didn't throw it like a rookie. So I think tremendous credit to him to being able to do and execute all of those things. But I give a lot of credit to the coach, too, because I think he understood exactly what the young quarterback needed to just kind of get his feet on the ground. And then when he felt like he was ready to pull the trigger on the big play, He called it.
And yet I think there were those who expected that Peterson would have handcuffed him a little bit more as far as throwing was concerned.
Well, I think that's the conventional wisdom, and I was one of those people who thought that you know—
I'm looking at you, Mike.
Yeah, a quarterback with so little relative experience, and not just at the highest level of football, but really at every level of football. Wentz was a starter in high school for only 1 year, only his senior year. At North Dakota State, which is a level of football that used to be called Division I AA, kind of a rung below the upper echelon of college football, he was a starter for less than two full seasons because he broke his wrist in his senior year. And then, of course, he only played basically a half of one preseason game for the Eagles. So in terms of just the pedigree of a quarterback getting to make his first start in a season opener as a number two overall pick, Wentz didn't have very much tangible experience. Yeah. So you can't get a read on what he's going to be like until you actually see it. And I think that was the reason. I don't know if you felt this way too, Ray, that kind of felt like, okay, they're going to take it easy on him because there's going to be something that the Browns and the Bears next week are going to throw at him that he hasn't seen and isn't familiar with. And at least yesterday, that didn't seem to be the case. He seemed to be pretty much ready for anything.
Yeah, I thought going into the game, I thought they would have him sort of on a pitch count. You know, like I figured he would throw somewhere 20 to 25 pass attempts. And I thought they would really run the ball a ton, partly because I thought that the Browns were a team you could run the ball successfully against. And the Eagles did to a degree. But, I mean, they didn't hold this kid back at all. I mean, he wound up throwing 37 passes, as you said. And that's – going into this game, I never would have expected him to be throwing 37 passes unless by some circumstance they found themselves way behind or were playing catch-up, which wasn't likely either. But to build a game plan with the idea that he was going to throw the ball 35 to 37 times, I didn't foresee that coming. But I think, again, it speaks to kind of what Mike was saying, is the level of confidence and true belief that this coaching staff had that this kid was ready to go out and, hey, he's not, you know, we don't have to handcuff him and we don't have to baby him. We'll just let him go out and play.
And yet if Peterson had used that game plan against a different team, say, I think they face Pittsburgh, what, maybe three,
in
2 weeks.
Weeks. 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks, okay. It could have been a different story.
Yeah, I think we've kind of hit on that the Browns are not going to win the Super Bowl this year. They'll be fortunate to win, you know, four or five games. So any NFL coach is going to game plan for a particular NFL team, and I'm certain Doug probably looked at the Browns and said, okay, you know, yeah, we're starting a rookie quarterback, but there are some situations we can take advantage of, and let's try to do that.
No interceptions, although it seems as if a bunch of his passes were knocked down. Does that say what do we read into that, if anything, Ray?
Not a whole lot. I mean, there were a couple balls that he was trying to throw quick screens or slip screens out of the backfield, which is really a pretty nice call. But the defender read it, got his hand up, tipped the ball. Actually, one of them could have turned into a ball that he could have tipped up in the air and intercepted and run in for a touchdown, which wouldn't have been good. But I mean, that's going to happen in a certain amount of situations almost any time. I thought his really good throws far outweighed those throws. I mean, he made some really good throws. I mean, he made a couple throws that you looked at those and you said, man, that's not a rookie throw. And I'm not just talking about the matter of pure arm strength, which he clearly has in abundance, but just reading the coverage, finding the receiver, knowing exactly how big the window was, and then fitting the ball in it. I mean, he just played with tremendous confidence.
Yeah. He took a lot of hits, though. And let's get into, you know, offensive concerns. We've got Lane Johnson, number one. How much longer is he in? Do we know yet when he is suspended? Because apparently the suspension is for, what, 10 weeks, right?
It'll be 10 games, yes. And he said either yesterday or earlier this week that he expects a ruling at some point this week. So if that were to happen, the Eagles would be without him, their starting right tackle, for the next 10 games.
And this is all over round two of the banned substance for Johnson. Okay,
yes.
So if for whatever reason he's out for 10 games, what happens next? What does Peterson have to do to shore up the offense?
Well, they will do what they were practicing already to do in the preseason, which is their plan B offensive line, which is taking Alan Barber, who's currently their left guard, and moving him out to right tackle, where he has played and has some experience, and then putting another player at left guard, either Ike Seumalo, who's a rookie that they drafted this year, or perhaps more likely probably Stefan Wisniewski, who's a veteran player they picked up from the Raiders. One of those two guys will step in and play guard, and Barber will play right tackle. So they'll still have five guys lined up there. They just won't be as good as the five that you had before. Lane Johnson is their best offensive lineman right now. And if they lose him, I mean, they're going to say they can get by, but the fact of the matter is that they won't be nearly as good.
It's a big loss. All right. Mike, you ask in Sunday's Inquirer, does Carson Wentz know what he's in for in Philadelphia? So he's the hero today. And if he has a rough couple games, you know, it's not going to be easy for him.
Well, we're in an interesting time, and I would be really curious to get Ray's perspective on this because he's far older than I am and has been around a lot longer and much wiser, I should say. All four of the major franchises in Philadelphia right now, the Phillies, the Eagles, the Flyers, and the Sixers, are kind of going through this transition phase where they've been rebuilding kind of from the ground up. And with at least the other three teams, the Phillies, the Flyers, and the Sixers, there's been a level of patience that you don't often see from Philadelphia sports fans, this belief that things will get better down the road even though they're not great right now. The Eagles have a little bit of that, but I also think that because Philadelphia, you know, there's something intrinsic in our guts about football and its importance relative to us as kind of our culture, that I just was asking, if Wentz gets off to a slow start or doesn't meet the expectations that have been set up for him, does he understand how big a deal that will be? Because it's something that the last franchise quarterback the Eagles had, Donovan McNabb, I'm not sure if he got it, he didn't always appreciate it, I think. You know, he got booed the day he was drafted. And I think that always kind of colored how he viewed the entire Delaware Valley and fans' perspective on him and the Eagles. And it was just something I was wondering about with respect to Wentz, that the fan base is so fervent, and he's coming from North Dakota, kind of the fan-friendliest place you could possibly come from. Does he know what he's in for?
Right. You want to weigh in?
It's a good question to ask. I think we all asked it. I mean, I certainly did. I think that McNabb is a very good test case there, because I really don't think McNabb ever forgot or got over being booed on draft day. I mean, he says he got over it, but he never really got over it. He would have been far better if he could have just cut it loose at some point, but he just could never let go of that. And it absolutely impacted the way he related to the fan base and they to him ultimately. Wentz never had that. I mean, Wentz was pretty much embraced from the beginning. I think people were excited by the Eagles' move to go up and get him. And where a lot of people would say you're going to be skeptical about spending that much and investing that much in a kid from North Dakota State, the fans here didn't feel that, because right away, I think the way this kid came in, the way he presented himself, he's extremely likable. He just comes off as extremely likable. And everything.
I'm confident.
For sure. And everything you heard from the scouts and everything you heard from the people that evaluated this kid or had anything to do with this kid, everything was totally positive. So I think the fans were fully on board with him from the beginning. And even though this isn't necessarily a patient city, which I think is kind of what Mike was alluding to, I think they recognized small college player coming into the NFL, it was going to take some time, and they were willing to ride with him. But when you have an opening day like yesterday, then the fans get that much more excited.
Oh, yeah. Then we're talking about the 2016 Eagles, game one yesterday over the Browns, 29-10. We've got Ray Dittinger in studio. He's football analyst for Comcast Sportsnet. Also, Mike Sielski, sports columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer. We are right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and we're talking about the 2016 Philadelphia Eagles. Mike Sielski's in studio with us. He's sports columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer and also the author of two books, Fading Echoes and How to Be Like Jackie Robinson, which he co-wrote with Pat Williams. Also, Ray Dittinger, who is football analyst for Comcast Sportsnet in Philadelphia. His latest book is The New Eagles Encyclopedia. And he's also written a play. We'll try to get to that a little bit later on in the show. But if you'd like to join the conversation, here's the number, 888-477-9499. What do you think of the birds? Or you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. So Sam Bradford, of course, traded to the Vikings recently. I'd read, I guess, up until recently that he was going to start I guess his first game against Tennessee, and he did not. The switch was made to Sean Hill. Surprised, right?
No, because they had said during the week that the plan was to let Hill play. They didn't feel that Sam was fully ready to go and run the whole playbook this week. So I would expect that he'll probably be out there next week, but they didn't feel like he was ready this week. So, I mean, they managed to get by in this game without scoring an offensive touchdown. So it was obvious that Sean Hill played like Sean Hill. So this week, I think they're going to accelerate the learning curve, and I would expect the Sam Bradford will be the quarterback for the next game.
So, Mike, as good as Wentz looked last night or yesterday afternoon, do you still think we're missing something without Bradford here?
No, I think the Eagles did what they had to do to kind of unmuddle a quarterback situation that had been kind of confused for virtually the entire offseason. They had spent a lot of money on the position between Bradford and the backup Chase Daniel. Then they went ahead and moved up twice in the draft to draft Carson Wentz and gave up some assets to get Wentz. And so the question always was, what is your plan here? What are you trying to have it both ways, kind of have your cake and eat it too? You want to try to compete this year with Sam Bradford. You shelled out all this money for him ostensibly at first because you thought, well, if he stays healthy and plays well, maybe he's our quarterback of the future. And then you kind of reversed course immediately after that and went after Carson Wentz. So are you going to do that? You're going to try to win now with Sam Bradford? Or are you trying to develop Carson Wentz, who's supposed to be your franchise quarterback in the future? And I think the fact that they were able to trade Bradford, clears all that up. You know, it became much more about, okay, we can begin the Wentz era now. We don't have to kind of keep up appearances by playing Bradford, even though we should be playing Wentz.
We've got calls and comments coming in to 888-477-9499. Also, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We've got a comment from Franco who says, Wentz looked amazing and a credit to the coach because for the first time in nearly 2 years, I saw my QB hike under the center instead of in the gun. Care to translate that, Ray?
There's a lot of truth to that. I mean, what he's talking about is the quarterback was running from an under center. He had his hand under center as opposed to playing the whole game in the shotgun. Chip did occasionally have the quarterback under center, but it was just occasionally. I mean, they really did run what amounted to a spread offense, and the quarterback was in the gun. What you saw yesterday was Carson Wentz was in the gun a lot, but he was also under center, which I fully expected because unlike a lot of college offenses today, which are almost exclusively spread formation with the quarterback and a shotgun, if you watched North Dakota State, I mean, they played with the quarterback. Wentz was under center a lot. I mean, he really was, and he was very comfortable under center. Now, he can play in the gun, but he was under center a lot. And as a result, he became a very good ball handler. I mean, he executes play fakes and things like that very well. So I think the Eagles recognized that. I think Peterson recognized that, and he began building that into the offense. And he did take a lot of snaps under center and did some very good things under center. And if he can run a play fake, like fake a handoff and hold the line and hold the linebackers, it will buy him more time in the pocket. It'll help him avoid some of the hits that he took yesterday. Mm-hmm. And it opens things up down the field. I mean, they ran a couple play fake type things where he wound up with receivers, Ertz, on a couple of occasions where he had 10 yards on space on either side of him, largely created by the play fake. So, yeah, I mean, I understand. I think the fans probably did feel that way, but this was a real different-looking kind of offense with this quarterback under center, and you'll see more of it with Carson Wentz.
All right, let's take a left turn for just a moment and talk about Chip Kelly. Les Bowen writes this week that he put the Eagles in a talent hole offensively, and this will be Howie Roseman's biggest challenge as he tries to assemble a championship, a worthy roster around Carson Wentz. Well, he wrote that before the game, mm-hmm. So not sure what he's thinking today. But what do you think of that, Mike?
Well, I think it gets to a question that every NFL team tries to answer, which is how much better can our quarterback make the players around him? You know, you have situations around the NFL where you have quarterbacks such as Tom Brady or Aaron Rodgers who you could put Ray and I on the outside as wide receivers and they would find a way to get us the ball and score touchdowns. But most teams don't have that. So I think initially we were kind of – everybody who covered the Eagles was kind of wondering, okay, we haven't seen Sam Bradford really elevate the talent around him in a way that those really elite quarterbacks can. So – and since we hadn't seen very much of Wentz, the question was, well – are they going to be able to help him in a way that a rookie quarterback might need to be helped? Now, here we are, you know, less than 24 hours after his first game, and everybody's asking, boy, you know, the Eagles player, the wide receivers and the tight ends and the running backs look pretty darn good because of Carson Wentz, at least for one day. So, you know, I think the Eagles are banking. They were always kind of banking that Wentz was going to be really, really good. And he was going to have to be really good because they had surrendered so many players who were on the team now, guys who were on the team now who had been starters and draft picks in the future to get new players who could come in and help him out.
So cornerback Eric Rowe is now with the Patriots. What's Roseman doing here, right? Sam doing what Chip Kelly put into play?
A little bit. I think that Eric Rowe was a guy that was drafted by the previous administration, by Chip, when Chip was making all the decisions. And Chip was one of these coaches that believes he has a certain paradigm for his players. Like you have to be at a certain position, he wants his players to be this tall, this heavy, then run this fast. And he had drafted Eric Rowe to play cornerback because Eric Rowe's 6 feet, 1.5, and he's tall and he has long arms, and that's exactly the kind of player Chip wants. The new coaching staff comes in now, Jim Schwartz is the defensive coordinator, and he isn't wedded to any of that. I mean, he just wants guys that can play. So the fact that Eric Rowe was 6'1 didn't matter to him. He brought in other guys that he felt played the position better, and frankly did. I mean, I felt all along that Eric Rowe was more of a safety than a corner. I thought he was a little out of position there. I didn't think he had, not to get too wonky here, but the footwork that you needed to play on the outside. Yeah. I think he can maybe play inside. I just thought he was miscast outside. Well, Jim Schwartz came to the same conclusion. And it was pretty obvious early on in training camp that he kept falling down the depth chart. I mean, originally everybody thought he'd be a starter. Next thing you know, he's second team. Next thing you know, he's running third team. And it was really, to me, it was just a matter of time that he was going to move on. And they were able to actually make a trade and get something back for him. And now he gets an opportunity to resurrect his career someplace else. But he goes to a team like New England, where you have a coach there who's very good at finding what guys do and letting them do it. So now he goes up to Bill Belichick, and there's a very good chance. Eric Rowe's a talented kid. I just think you have to put him in the right spot. He could go to New England and play very well.
There's another part to that Chip Kelly paradigm, too, which is that from an attitudinal standpoint and a personality standpoint, he wanted guys who were probably tended more towards the choir boy end of the personality. Mm-hmm. He didn't want guys who were going to make trouble. And Schwartz, the new defensive coordinator, wants guys who are really aggressive by nature. And I think from a personality standpoint, Rowe didn't quite fit what Schwartz was looking for. He'd take the shorter guy, maybe a little slower guy even. But if he had, that aggressive nature, that kind of just that word, aggressiveness, then he'd be more inclined to like him and like the style of play.
One more question about Chip, and then I promise we'll move on. But, speaking of temperament, how do you think what do you think of his response to Colin Kaepernick's refusal to stand during the national anthem, right? Kaepernick's not starting.
Right. But I don't think that's the same decision. I think that he had already made up his mind that Kaepernick had issues other than the issue about the national anthem. No, he had already lost his job. Chip had made the decision he was going to go with Blaine Gabbert as his quarterback anyway, which I find hard to imagine. I mean, I don't think Blaine Gabbert is an NFL quarterback. I don't think you can win with him in the National Football League. I really don't. And the fact that Chip decided that he's going to be his starting quarterback to me was very puzzling. Because one of the things...
And it doesn't have anything to do with the personality, the dissonance?
Well, certainly it has nothing to do with the National Anthem, because that decision was made way before that.
Right, but in general...
There's a disconnect between the two of them to the point where I kind of thought it wouldn't have surprised me terribly if Chip had decided to move on from Kaepernick, because it doesn't make any sense for me, at least for what I know of Chip and Chip's style of play, for him to have Colin Kaepernick on his roster but yet have him behind Blaine Gabbert. I mean, that to me is the part that doesn't make any sense. If he doesn't like Colin Kaepernick for whatever reason, then move him on to somebody else. But to have him behind a guy who I think is a clearly inferior quarterback to like Blaine Gabbert, that's the part that doesn't make any sense. One thing Chip Kelly doesn't care about is protecting his quarterbacks. He doesn't care about protecting him. If you watch his protection schemes, it's clear. He doesn't mind his quarterbacks getting hit. And Blaine Gabbert is one of those quarterbacks that you absolutely have to start with protection with him, because if he gets hit, he's going to be ineffective. So the Chip Kelly-Blaine Gabbert marriage, to me, is one that has no chance of succeeding.
Okay, and back to Kaepernick for a second. Kelly repeatedly made it clear he respects Kaepernick's right to express his feelings. And so I guess we could just kind of, end that line of questioning there, unless you have something to say.
No, I was just going to say that remember that part of the reason in retrospect that Kelly's tenure kind of disintegrated, I think, was that early on in his tenure, he made the decision after consultation with people within the organization and outside of the organization to keep Riley Cooper on the roster after Cooper had used, you know, a racial slur, had been called using a racial slur at a concert. So it's not, you know, if you look at the calculus in Chip's head, he's clearly willing to put up with some sort of distraction if he thinks it's better, you know, for the football team overall.
Back to the Eagles. Let's talk about Chase Daniel. He's Wentz's backup now. He was expected to compete for the top job. At, you know, what is he? He's 29 years old, in the NFL 8 years. So why didn't this pan out for him, right?
I never thought he was going to compete for the starting job.
Okay. Maybe I read that someplace. No, I'm parroting it.
I mean, well, no. I mean,
you read it because Doug Peterson said
it. Exactly.
Oh, okay. Oh,
yes. Exactly. I mean,
that's where I got it.
No, you're not wrong. I mean, that was the explanation when they brought him in here, that he was supposed to be competition for either Sam Bradford if he was going to be the incumbent coming back, or perhaps Carson Wentz if he was promoted to this. But the fact is he doesn't really figure to compete with either one of them. Chase Daniel is – this is kind of what he is. I mean, he's a guy, if he's going to play in the National Football League, and he's been around for a while, is a backup. He's a guy of very limited skills. I mean, he was an okay player at the University of Missouri, but he's very small. He doesn't have a particularly good arm. And all of those limitations are accentuated by the speed and the size of the NFL game. I mean, he's never a guy that's going to be able to compete successfully as a starting quarterback. If you were ever to make Chase Daniel your starting quarterback, you're committing yourself to a losing season. Mm-hmm. Now, does he have value on a staff? I guess Doug Peterson feels that way. He was his backup in Kansas City, and he brought him here with the idea that he would help teach these guys or tutor these guys on the offense. That's really what he's here for. I don't think he was ever really brought in as true competition for whoever the number one quarterback was.
So as a number two would say, he says he's prepared. He prepares as if he's going to start. He's quoted in the Inquirer as saying it's still one snap away. And as I'm watching the game yesterday and Wentz is getting hit and I'm thinking, have those fractured ribs really healed? You have to wonder about that, Mike Sielski.
You do. And Ray and I were talking before the show, and if you were to go into the Eagles locker room as somebody who had no idea what any of the players looked like, and you stood Chase Daniel next to John Dorenbos, the team's long snapper, and looked at the two of them, and someone said, okay, pick out which one is the backup quarterback and pick out which one is the long snapper, I defy you to be able to do it because they're built exactly the same way. They're both kind of built like fire hydrants. And what's interesting to me about Daniel's presence is that it's fine now that Sam Bradford is no longer here and Carson Wentz is the clear starter and Daniel's the backup. And yes, if Wentz were to get hurt and Daniel were to play, you know, there would be a marked difference in quality of play, I think. But his presence while Sam Bradford was here for the entire offseason never really made sense. If your goal was, well, we're going to try to win with Sam Bradford, okay, well, then you have Sam Bradford as your starter and Carson Wentz as your backup. If your plan is, well, we're going to groom Carson Wentz and we're looking to the future, then okay, well then play Wentz or keep Daniel as the backup. It gets back to what I'd said earlier about the muddled thinking and the idea of being a coach on the team. The problem with that thinking, if you're an NFL organization, is that by being a player and by being paid what's, you know, technically $7 million a year, you're taking up space and under a finite salary cap. You know, he's not a coach. He's taking up space and money that could be spent elsewhere, and the Eagles only have so much money to spend on the players on their roster. So nobody should be expecting anything great out of Chase Daniel this season. Nice guy, smart guy, not a great NFL quarterback.
Let's talk about Doug Peterson and Andy Reid. Reid is Peterson's mentor. Give us a brief history of the time the two men have spent together professionally, right?
Well, it goes back to Green Bay when Andy was an assistant coach there under Mike Holmgren. Doug was a backup quarterback there. That was where they met. And then when Andy became a head coach in Philadelphia and they drafted Donovan McNabb, he didn't want to be in a position where he had to start Donovan McNabb right away if in fact he wasn't ready to play. So he brought Doug Peterson with him from Green Bay as a guy who understood his playbook, understood his offense, and could sort of hold the fort until Donovan was ready to play. That's the role that Doug was signed for. That's the role that he played. And he started about the first half of the season, and then when they felt Donovan was ready to play, then Donovan took over and remained the quarterback. And then when Andy moved on later down the road as the Eagles coach, he brought Doug in as an assistant coach on his staff. And then when Andy left Philadelphia and went to Kansas City, he brought Doug to Kansas City with him and last year promoted him to offensive coordinator. So they've been together for a long time in three different spots. And in many ways, Doug is very much like Andy in terms
of his next question.
In offensive philosophy and everything. And that's a big reason why he was the hire, because I think Jeff Lurie, after the whole Chip Kelly thing, I think Jeffrey kind of wanted to go back. He wanted to hit the reset button and go back to the Andy Reid era. Well, he couldn't get Andy, so he went and got Doug.
And yet the quest for the Super Bowl ring continues, Mike Sielski.
It does. I think what's interesting about what Lurie is trying to do in this particular era is, in some ways, he's kind of misreading history. He wanted in some ways he isn't, in some ways he isn't. He wanted to recapture what Andy Reid had. And that's fine. There was a lot of that was very good. But the primary reason I'd argue that it was very good and that they were able to maintain a level of consistency and consistent excellence for as long as they did was because they got the right quarterback. They got Donovan McNabb, who was a very solid to excellent and at times great NFL quarterback. And that allowed them to do the sorts of things and make the sort of personnel decisions that can keep a team there. Once you have the guy who you know is the guy at quarterback, then it kind of frees you to do the things you need to do to maintain that level of consistent excellence. Initially, I was wondering if they were leaving that step out just by hiring Doug Peterson, the Andy Reid protege. They took the step then to go get a guy in Carson Wentz who they think may be the franchise quarterback. Let's see if he turns out to be the guy.
All right, Eagles over the Browns, 29-10. First game of the season. Does this set the stage? Mike Sielski is here in studio. He's sports columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer, as is Ray Dittinger, football analyst for Comcast Sportsnet. And if you'd like to tell us what you think about this latest version of the Birds, 888-477-9499 is the number. Keep it here. Radio Times is back in just a moment. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We're talking about the Philadelphia Eagles, and we're also going to try to get to the Phillies and the Sixers and see what they're up to, or at least look into the crystal ball a little bit with Mike Sielski, sports columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Ray Dittinger, football analyst for Comcast Sportsnet. The number to call, 888-477-9499. You can shoot us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So a few more questions about the Eagles before we move on. How many games until we really know who these Eagles are, Mike?
It's interesting. We were a few of the writers who cover the team were discussing this last night, and I think Bill Belichick, the Patriots' well-known and very accomplished head coach, said something that you never really find out who your team is until October. So I think that's a pretty good set of parameters to gauge them. You know, you get to the middle of October, if they're 4-1, 3-2, and Carson Wentz has continued to play at a level approximating what he showed yesterday, then you may have a pretty good sense of who they are. Having said that, things can change very quickly in the NFL. You look at a team last year like the Atlanta Falcons, who came in with a new head coach, a guy named Dan Quinn, got off to a rip-roaring start. They were 6-2. They were poised to make a playoff run, it looked like. And in the second half of the season, the bottom fell out and they didn't even make the playoffs. I do think that a head coach's newness, for instance, in the case of Peterson, can be an advantage early in a season as his opponents try to figure out what his tendencies are, strengths and weaknesses, what is his team trying to do. And I do think in a lot of situations, those opponents eventually figure it out after a while.
Ray, you're nodding your head.
Oh, I think it's true. I think that it's – and it may be more late October than early October, but October is a pretty good general rule of thumb, and it is. Things do change. The one thing I think about this team is I do think their defense is good, and I do think their defense is going to be, barring a whole bunch of injuries, I think their defense is going to be something that they can kind of count on week after week. I think it's going to keep them in just about every game. I think they're really good on the front four. I think their secondary is good. I think their safeties are good. The corners – to me, it played a little better, and I thought they were going to. The linebackers are thin, but they're kind of They're kind of going to get by, I feel. I think the defense, we kind of know what that's going to be week to week. I really believe that. The offense is going to be the area where you're not going to be quite sure. And part of it's going to deal with the fact that you have a rookie quarterback who, like all rookie quarterbacks, I suspect is going to have his ups and downs. And something you alluded to at the beginning, which is a real concern to me, are the number of hits he's taking. I mean, I just don't know if he keeps getting slammed to the ground the way he did yesterday, if he's going to make it through 16 games. I just don't. And I think the coaches, in terms of their game planning week to week, are going to have to be mindful of that and try and be aware of that. And to some degree, he's going to have to be aware of that. I mean, he had, when I was doing my scouting report on him in college, one of the things I noted was sometimes the term I used was he flees a clean pocket. In other words, the pocket in front of him will be okay, but he won't trust that it's going to be okay, and so he'll try to run out of there. And there were some times yesterday where he had space in front of him where he could have stepped up and delivered the ball to an open receiver, but his instincts took him to the outside, and as soon as he turned outside, he ran right into a
rookie mistake.
He ran right into a blitzer and took a big hit as a result. So the one of the things he's going to have to learn is that pro thing, which is you don't have to worry about it in college, but the willingness to step up in the pocket and deliver the ball. You're more likely to be okay doing that than you are to try and turn and run out of it, because you're more likely to run into trouble.
And to buttress Ray's point about the potential impact of injury and Wentz's need to stay healthy, you didn't have to look but across the field yesterday at the Cleveland Browns quarterback, Robert Griffin III, for an example of what debilitating injury can do to a quarterback. Go back to the season opener in 2002 when Griffin was playing for the Washington Redskins. He had a better debut that day against a better team, the New Orleans Saints, who had been 13-3 the year before, than Wentz had yesterday.
300 yards, right?
320 yards, two touchdowns. Everybody in the nation's capital was raving about Robert Griffin III in the same way Philadelphia is raving about Carson Wentz now. And what happened is he suffered a couple injuries. His style of play, again, started to get figured out a bit by the league. There were some other issues with him and the Redskins organization. And you're looking at a guy now who, you know, 3-4 years later is kind of got a wing and a prayer chance with a franchise that isn't going anywhere anytime soon.
He didn't get a lot of support yesterday.
No, he sure didn't.
But he doesn't even look like the same player now.
Right.
But that's the really, and it's not like we're talking about a period of 12 or 15 years. You're just talking about really relatively few years. And his rookie year, he was probably the most exciting player in the NFL. And now he's a guy that I'm not sure that he's ever going to be anything better than mediocre. And so that's the one thing you always have to worry about, that first game overreacting to Carson Wentz, as good as it was.
Sure.
You go back to the first game of Robert Griffin III, and it was even better. And now here you are. He's on his second team and trying to rebuild his career.
Yeah, time will tell. All right, let's get to the phones. We've got calls coming in to 888-477-9499. John in Bethlehem, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. So basically, when I watch football, I'm basically a fundamental guy. I just want to watch you play football, do fundamental tackling, blocking, and do everything. And I feel that we have finally got back to that under Chip Kelly. It seemed to be a whole lot of philosophy, and he got away from, you know, the fundamentals of the game. And it was nice to watch the first game and say, oh, we're back. Okay, we're back to the fundamental, watching football and, you know, being an Eagles fan on top of it. Is a bonus.
So quickly, John, what did you think of Carson Wentz? And are you kind of reserving judgment looking down the road a little bit?
I can't see how you not reserve your judgment. You know, every year as an Eagles fan, you know, I was born and bred in Philadelphia, moved up to Bethlehem, but you always start off with the season with big hopes, and then, you know, lately, anyway, and they seem to be dashed. Andy Reid era was a lot of good football, hard hitting football, where we were just, you know, so close, but just
no ring,
didn't quite get there.
Yeah, John, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You hear this a lot, I'm sure, Mike Sielski.
Sure, you know, it's in our DNA, I think. And again, Ray and I were discussing this before the show. Philadelphia has this reputation, and rightfully so, as this gritty, tough sports town that can be very difficult on its athletes, often its superstars. But by the same token, there's also this kind of romantic streak there, too, where we want the winning so badly, we want the championship so badly, particularly with respect to the Eagles, because I do think we're a football town first and foremost, that when you have a situation like yesterday and a player like Wentz shows as much promise as he does, we immediately want to latch on to that and say, this is it. It's going to be great now. You know, we finally got the guy. And, you know, Ray and I were discussing how many times has that happened where it was Donovan McNabb was going to be that guy. Eric Lindros was going to be that guy for the Flyers. Allen Iverson was going to be that guy for the Sixers. And, you know, with the exception of the Phillies in 2008, it never quite materializes.
I'm so sorry about the image, but it's Charlie Brown in the football.
A little bit, you know, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. We've got a comment from Tony on a more serious note. He says, can you talk about racial bias in NFL coaching? For example, Chip Kelly has been bouncing around from team to team with failing records, but has job security. Anything to that, Ray?
Well, I don't know that Chip has bounced around to a whole lot of teams. I mean, yeah. He was at the Eagles and now he's with San Francisco. He may be bouncing out of San Francisco sooner rather than later. I think Chip's in for a long year there. Well, I mean, I've been covering the league long enough that I remember a time when there were absolutely no African-American coaches, none. And, you know, Denny Green came in and then Tony Dungy came in and now Mike Tomlin has been coaching in Pittsburgh for a long time. I don't think it's just a pro football thing. I mean, the league is right now, last time I checked, I think they said it's like 75% African-American players. And the representation of coaches does not reflect that at all, be they head coaches or assistant coaches, I mean, through the whole roster. I think the league is trying to address it to some degree. They have a minority coaching program where they bring in African-American coaches, minority coaches, to serve as interns during training camp and try and introduce these guys to the game and introduce them to owners and hopefully work them up the ladder. The league has introduced what they call the Rooney Rule, which means every year when a team is trying to hire a new head coach, they have to interview at least one minority candidate. Some people can question the validity of the rule. Some people say that the interviews aren't real interviews. They're just filling a quota. But the fact of the matter is that if a guy goes out and he's interviewed, even if they're not going to hire him, the fact that an owner interviews him, sometimes his name can get in circulation. That was how Mike Tomlin got hired in Pittsburgh. People just heard about him and said, this guy's a smart guy. Steelers interviewed him and hired him. Does it have to be better? I absolutely think it has to be better. But I do think that we're seeing it's a heck of a lot healthier in that regard than it was when I first started covering the league in 70.
One more question regarding football before we move on to try to get a couple of Phillies questions in before the end of the hour. Phillies got the 2017 draft, so mm-hmm. Hooray. it's been, 50 years, at least 50 years. The city has to cough up $5 million of the $25 million price tag, but the draft could bring in $86 million. Win-win, Mike Seals?
I'm always skeptical. I'm skeptical whenever a city or municipality sells a big project. You often hear this with respect to building a stadium, that it's going to be economically beneficial. It'll be beneficial in the sense that lately Philadelphia generally has done a pretty good job of hosting these kind of events, and we've had a number of them lately. We obviously had the Democratic National Convention. We had the Pope come last year. I think it makes it easier to host these kind of events when you shut off all traffic and lock down the entire city as if a giant monster from a Japanese monster movie were coming to town instead of Hillary Clinton or Pope Francis.
And but you need good weather for this, too.
And
it's
you do.
All outdoors.
You do. And in April. And I think people who don't follow the NFL, don't immerse themselves in the day-to-day of the NFL, might not appreciate how big an event the draft has become. I mean, it's Philadelphia is literally going to be the focal point of the entire sports world for a week leading into and including this draft. It's not a one-day thing. It's now Thursday night in prime time. It's Friday in prime time, and it's all day Saturday. So it's a pretty big deal.
Right. And the draft started in Philadelphia, the very first NFL draft when it was instituted and created. They started it at what was then the Bellevue Stratford Hotel in the city. So they're sort of coming back to their roots here.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Back home.
Camden almost had it in 2005. They almost got it.
All right. Well, let's go to the Phillies because we are up against the clock. Ryan Howard, where does his career go beyond 2016?
If it does, I don't think it will be in Philadelphia. Yeah. He wants to play another year. I think he feels like the power he's shown, the number of home runs he's hit this year shows that he can help another team. The question is whether there is a team, particularly in the American League, that uses the designated hitter that is out there that's going to want to sign him.
Okay. And you wrote in your sports column for the Yankee earlier this summer, I think you alluded to this earlier in the show, that, quote, we're at a moment in time in Philadelphia sports. We're at that precious point where it's never better to be a fan here. So you're referring to some really exciting stuff that's going on.
Yeah.
You've got Carson Wentz. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, we like it in Philadelphia. The one thing that we don't handle well, I think, are high expectations. If you go back to the 2011 Phillies, for instance, with that incredible starting rotation, that was almost the worst of all worlds because there was this expectation that they were going to win the World Series, and we don't deal well with that. But if you go around to the Phillies and the young talent they have there, if you go to the Eagles and Carson Wentz, you go to the Sixers with Ben Simmons, who is the number one pick in the draft, and Joel Embiid maybe being healthy, and some of the other young players that they have, the Flyers and the building through their farm system that they've done, there's a lot of hope out there now. And that's what we like. It's that looking forward and believing that something will be better tomorrow.
You got to have that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, and by the way, Ben Simmons, there's merchandise with his name on it now, apparently being snapped up not only in Philly but across the whole world. The question is, will this stuff be selling in a year?
I think so, yeah. I think he's a really good player. I mean, his ball handling skills are terrific, especially for a player who's 6'10" tall. He's very versatile. If there's a weakness in his game, it's his shooting ability. And that, according to Billy Lang, who's an assistant coach for the Sixers, is the skill that is easiest to develop and correct. And believe me, the Sixers have a lot of invested in this young man. They're going to do everything they can to try to correct it.
What do you think, quickly, Ray?
Oh, no, I think there's – the best thing you can say about the Sixers right now is there is some real expectation and anticipation about their season. And you couldn't have said that about the last couple of years. But there's a feeling right now that people want to go see Sixers games. And I don't know how long it's going to last, but at least you're coming into the season where there's going to be a little buzz about the team. And I think the key – Simmons, I agree with Mike. I think Simmons is going to be a fine player, a really good player. I think the key to the team ultimately becoming what they hope it's going to become is Embiid.
Yes.
I mean, he is a physically dominant force. And if he can stay healthy and become the player that they think that he can be, you put him on the floor with those other guys, then you have a chance to have something really special.
Is there a plus here with Elton Brand back? Plus, or?
A seasoned veteran, a guy who can kind of show the young players the ropes. Beyond that, that's about it.
Okay. Well, Ray, you can now add to your resume, playwright. want to tell us a bit about Tommy and Me?
Yeah, it was a play that I wrote. I had never written a play before, and I wrote a play. It took me about 2 years to develop it. But it was a story about me and my relationship with Tommy McDonald, the great Eagles Hall of Fame receiver, starting out from the time when I was a little boy, a 9-year-old boy, chasing after him for his autograph up at Eagles training camp, and him letting me carry his helmet to practice. And then later on, when I became a sports writer, sort of leading the effort to try and get him in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And then finally, when he was voted in the Hall of Fame, he turned around and asked me to be his presenter. So it was kind of this kind of life coming full circle sort of story that I always thought was just kind of unique and kind of warm and fuzzy and kind of makes you feel good. So I just decided one day, you know, I don't know if this is a book, but it seems like more than a newspaper article. You know, maybe it's a play. So I sat down and wrote it, and a local theater company, Theater Exile, liked it enough that they decided to put it on a stage. And we did it at the Fringe Arts Theater here in Philadelphia in August, and it ran 12 performances, sold out all 12 performances, and got well-reviewed enough that we have four or five different theater companies that are now interested in perhaps putting it on next year's schedule. So, Tommy and Me may yet live on.
All right. So before we wrap up, I did want to get back to the Eagles for one moment. I know we talked about, you know, knowing the team and mid to late October, but if you'd like to prognosticate for just a moment, how many wins do you think, Mike Sielski? Just a guess. Pull it out of the hat.
I would say probably around seven. Somewhere between six and eight, and I'll say seven.
Okay. Jim Ray?
Before the year started, I said five, and I'm not somebody that bounces around from week to week, so I'll say five, and
five.
If I'm proven wrong, I'll be proven wrong, but I will say this. After yesterday, I'm a little more optimistic than I was a week ago.
Yeah, still, Carson Wentz is going to be challenged.
For sure.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Ray Dittinger, football analyst for Comcast SportsNet in Philadelphia, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
And Mike Sielski, as always, great to have you here.
Great to be here, Mary. Thanks.
Mike is sports columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and as always, it's great to have you along for the conversation on Radio Times.